Well, it's about time to start. So good to see everybody. Welcome to our Bible study tonight. We'll be in Exodus chapter 15 in just a moment as we continue our study through Exodus and the wandering in the wilderness. We've just exited Egypt and we're about to wander in the wilderness for a while. So we're right in the middle of all of that. Again, good to have you with us. If you're visiting with us, we're going through the Bible narrative and all of our Bible classes. In this quarter, we're studying most all of the classes are studying this same section. In our last class period, we did have the Israelites being freed from Egyptian bondage, escaping through the Red Sea as God parted it, the Egyptians being destroyed, and the Israelites winding up on the other side, freed from slavery, praising God and rejoicing for the great deliverance that He had given them. So we pick up in Exodus 15 and verse 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. As Cameron was mentioning Sunday morning, and I thought he did a good job dealing with this, the exact route of the Exodus is not known for certain. There is a traditional route that I think is probable, at least possible, but I think it's probable that this is in fact the route that they take. I was talking to Scott Richardson yesterday morning. Scott, who we support actually up in Tennessee, in Bethel, Tennessee. But Scott, as many of you know, produced these maps that we use. They're used all over the world, actually. They're high quality Bible maps. And he's done a lot of research into the Exodus route. He said he actually has made a map that has 8 different routes that could have been taken, 8 different ones. And I think that's interesting, somebody of his understanding of the geography and all of that over there. And so we had some discussion about this yesterday. So there's on this map, Scott put this question mark up there. That's his question mark that he has on this map to say, again, not sure, but probably. And I say that to say this. I'll be showing you some pictures and some maps on this section, like this one that's in front of you. And I still think there's value to that, even though we're not 100% certain the exact route that was taken. I think that there's value to it for a couple of reasons. First of all, pretty much all of the Sinai Peninsula and all of the part of Arabia on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba, where the other route could have gone that way, pretty much all of that territory looks exactly the same, okay? It's not like you're looking at vastly different places. These places, one of the reasons you don't really know, because it's a trackless wilderness where no cities have been, you know, and people don't generally live there and stay there for centuries and centuries, so you don't really know where things are. It's a place where a lot of nomadic kind of people live, and so it's hard to know exactly where everything is. So when you're looking at the maps, and especially pictures, it may not be exactly the place, but it's a place like exactly the place. We can say that for sure. And so it represents that to your mind, and I think there's some profit in that. I'll also say this. There are a lot of religions in this world that have histories that are entirely mythical. You can think of parts of the Greek and Roman religions of ancient times. You can think of Hinduism, for instance, Buddhism, that has just mythical happenings and places in the stories that are the background to their religions. There is no mythical story in the Bible. The places are real. We may not be able to find exactly the spot that these things occurred, but they occurred in some spot near this. We know that. These are real places. And so I think there's some value in trying to explore this a little bit just for that reason. I do appreciate Cameron's warning that not every archaeological claim about biblical history, especially this section of it, should necessarily be believed or swallowed. But there are some interesting things to look at and think about. So I present that to you as we start. And we'll look at, in this map, you see, we just learned that they crossed the Red Sea, they come into the wilderness of Shur, and we're pretty sure that's where Shur is, if you don't mind me using Shur so much. So that much of it seems to be fairly accurate. So we're looking in 15:22. They come into the wilderness of Shur, go 3 days. They came to Marah, and could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it is called Marah. So they're into the wilderness, through Shur. They find no water. They come to Marah. They've been now 3 days at least without water, but the water there is bitter and they can't drink it. So the text tells us that the people complain. The people complain. And we're going to find a lot of complaining that the children of Israel do. Verse 2, they complained. This word for complain, the specific Hebrew word that's found here, is found in Exodus, here in Exodus 15, in Exodus 16, in Exodus 17. You go over to Numbers, it's found in Numbers 14, Numbers 16, and Numbers 17. Not just one time, but several times in these passages. They do a lot of complaining. A lot of complaining. And we can learn lessons about the dangers of complaining. What does complaining demonstrate when you're dealing with God or He's dealing with you and you begin to complain? What does it demonstrate? Disrespect? What? Lack of faith? Lack of trust that He's doing the best thing? Lack of trust that He's going to take care of you? You know, and that He, or that He is taking care of you? And God is bringing these the children of Israel out to teach them, among other things, to trust Him. And every time they complain, it shows that they don't trust Him, right? We learn in the New Testament, Proverbs 2 and verse 4, Proverbs, Philippians 2 and verse 14, do all things without complaining. Do all things without complaining. Everything God asks us to do, let's do those things without complaining. The Israelites needed to learn that. We need to learn the same lesson. There's a great lesson in this. We look at the Israelites, we see their complaints, we need to understand. We need the same lesson that the Israelites needed. In fact, the Apostle Paul says that specifically when he writes about this time period. 1 Corinthians 10, verses 10 and 11. We're told not to complain as some of them complain, talking about the Israelites. Don't complain as some of them complain and were destroyed by the destroyer. And then in verse 11 of 1 Corinthians 10, he said, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. The things that we're reading tonight were written for our admonition. All right. This complaining issue that we're looking at here is not the specific one that Paul's talking about, but the issue of complaining is the same problem. So, God takes care of them here. Here's probably where Marah is, at least according to the traditional route. God tells Moses to cast a tree into the water and make it sweet, and he does, and it does become sweet so that they can drink it. God provides for them in this case, as He will all the way through this experience. And then God promises Israel that if they'll obey, He will not afflict them with the diseases of Egypt. Look at verse 27. I'm in Exodus 15, verse 27 now. If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord, your God, and do what is right in His eyes, give ear to His commandments and His statutes, I will put none of the diseases on which I have brought you, I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. God can be trusted to provide for their physical necessities, to provide even for their health. Just rely on Me, He's telling them. Just trust in Me. And you show your trust in God, you show your faith in Him by obedience. By obedience. We show we trust God by doing what He says, even when it doesn't necessarily, you know, what the Israelites are being told to do is, you follow Me and follow Moses into this trackless wilderness, and it's all going to be good, and I'm going to give you a land flowing with milk and honey. Well, why are we going through the trackless wilderness? You know, you have a lot of questions about this, right? There's not a lot of water out here. There's not food out here. They'll complain about all of that, showing that they don't trust God. They're not willing to wholly obey Him. Well, Israel then, in the next section, comes to Elam. And Elam is described in verse 27 as a place where there are 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees. So they camp there by the waters. How many wells were there? 12. Wonder if that's an accident. We're going to go through, as we go through, even tonight's story, we'll see 12 coming into the story another time. And the number 12, of course, is symbolic of the people of God. All the way through the Old Testament, it's used that way. There will be 12 stones that are put in the River Jordan and 12 stones that are erected on the other side of the River Jordan and all sorts of 12s all through. And then when you get to the book of Revelation, people wonder, well, why do we have that number 12 all the way through the book of Revelation? Well, it's representative of the people of God. And when you see that, that's what it refers to. But the background of that is in the story, again, that we're looking at tonight. Yep. There is, I think, as well, the 70 palms. And 70 comes up, actually, as a number that's significant a little bit later on. So this may be where Elam is. This is a possible site of Elam. And all I can say about that, I don't necessarily think that that's Elam, but what it does say to us is, are there places in the middle of this trackless wilderness where you have palm trees and wells of water? The answer to that is yes. We call them oases, or an oasis, and the Sinai has oases, plural, in it. And this is one. If this is exactly Elam, I don't think anybody knows for sure. I'm sure they sell tourist water here, you know, and say that it's Elam, but I'm not sure that that's where it is. But the point is that, yes, there are these places in the wilderness. This is a real story. And what we find here goes along with the story. So we pick it up as we go into chapter 16. Any other questions or thoughts before we do that? Look at this, looking at this next section. All right. In chapter 16, Israel leaves Elam and comes into the wilderness of Sin 1 month after leaving Egypt. So here you have at least what we label in this rendition of the route as the wilderness of Sin. And guess what happens? The whole congregation, verse 2, of the children of Israel complained against Moses and against Aaron in the wilderness. The children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So now they've just got over a time when they didn't have any water. Now they don't have anything to eat, and they're complaining about that. This particular complaint is a sad and sorry one, if you think about it. Their plight in Egypt was horrendous. And here they say, God is mistreating us so badly out here in the wilderness, we'd rather go back to Egypt. What a slap in the face to the God of heaven, who has said, I'll provide for you. I'll give you everything you need, including not give you any diseases and heal you and everything. So again, shows a lot of lack of faith, but God is patient and he's trying to build their faith, to have them learn that they can trust him. So God promises to provide bread, but it's a test of their obedience, as we've said. Let's look at the reading in verse 4. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, for the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not." So God says, I'm going to provide for you, but it's also going to be a test of your obedience. Every blessing is a test of whether or not we're going to do what God said do with that blessing. Every blessing that we have is a test of our obedience. And he says then, "It shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily." So God's promising, I'm going to give them bread on the sixth day. Part of the test is they're going to, you know, gather twice as much and not gather on the next day. He's going to set up the Sabbath here in a minute. But that's going to be the test of their obedience. This also, this part of this story, relates to some important truths in the New Testament that also relate to us. In John chapter 6, Jesus feeds the 5,000, goes over to Capernaum, and he has this discussion with the people about they want more bread. And they say, our fathers gave us, God gave us manna, Moses gave us manna in the wilderness. Moses gave us manna in the wilderness, and so won't you give us more bread to eat, is basically what they're saying in John 6. And Jesus tells them, I am the bread of life. I am the manna that's come down from heaven, the true manna that you can eat and live forever. They didn't believe him. They didn't trust him about that any more than the Israelites trusted God in the wilderness. It's a test of our faith as well. Do we believe that Jesus is the manna from heaven, the bread of life that we can take and eat and live forever? All of this, again, comes down to our lives today. Well, Moses then explains that God's going to provide and that Israel's complaints are not really against him, but against the Lord. Look at verse 6. Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel at evening, you shall know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your complaints against the Lord. What are we that you complain against us? Also Moses said, this shall be seen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and in the morning, bread to the full, for the Lord hears your complaints which you make against him. What are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Lord. We should be very careful about complaining, because after all, God is also the originator of our blessings. And when we complain about our blessings, our circumstances, our life, aren't we complaining somewhat about what God has provided us? It's a great lesson for us to learn. God speaks to Moses then before the whole congregation. Moses spoke to Aaron, tells Aaron in verse 9, go tell the congregation to come near to the Lord because he's heard your complaints. In verse 10, it came to pass as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel that they looked toward the wilderness and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in a cloud, this cloud where God's glory appears, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, now, this is going to happen several times where God interacts with Moses on through this section from Sinai and onward. God's going to interact with Moses multiple times in the sight of the people. And what that does, of course, is it puts God's stamp of approval on Moses as his messenger. They realize Moses isn't, you know, making this stuff up. God is directly speaking to Moses. And they see that with their eyes as the voice apparently comes out of this cloud and they hear it speaking to Moses in some way, or they see that is happening. So this is no doubt impressive to them. God says to Moses, tells him about giving the meat, the quail is going to come in, tells him about the manna being given as well. So we come to verse 15, and the children of Israel, when they saw the manna, the layer of dew, it says, lifted in the morning in verse 14 on the surface of the wilderness, small round substance as fine as frost on the ground. When the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. Moses said, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. And then the Lord gives them some regulations concerning the manna. We're going to call them manna rules. Okay, manna rules. You have blessings. God's going to make rules about how he wants those blessings used. That's only fair since he gave you the blessing, right? That's what we have in this case. God tells them in verses 16 through 18 that they're to gather only one omer per person. And that's all they needed to gather for each person in a household. An omer is about 2 quarts. I'll show you the conversion table here in a minute. So it's about 2 quarts of food that was to be gathered for each person. If any was left over, and it should not be left over, if it was, it would breed worms and stink. So don't do that. A double portion was to be gathered the day before the Sabbath. He's already indicated this, but he specifies it in the giving of these rules. Look at verse 22 along this line then. It was on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. All the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. He said to them, "This is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is the Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, and boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all the remains to be kept until morning." You notice, up until this time, for 6 days, if they had any left over, it would spoil by morning. But if you bake it or boil it before the Sabbath, it'll keep. And so that's what they were told to do. They laid it up till morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Moses said, "Eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none." What we need to know about this, I think maybe more than anything else, is this is the first time the Bible mentions the Sabbath. It's going to be a day of rest. It's a day of rest because God has provided. He's provided for a day of rest. There are going to be a lot of other rules and regulations associated with the Sabbath, but here's the foundation of it. Here's the beginning of it. "I have provided for you plenty enough so you can rest on the Sabbath day." And so at the core, that's what it's going to be. When they get to Sinai, he's going to give more rules and regulations about it. So what happened when these rules were broken? Well, nothing good happened. Whether it was, you know, the manna melting away in the hot sun, if it was left, to the manna rotting in the pots, if it was kept overnight, and nothing good happened by disobeying God. They found that out as well. So they're learning. They're learning about what God expects. Here's some facts about manna that you might find interesting. The word manna means, what is it? First thing they said in verse 15, when they saw it on the ground that morning, what is it? And in Hebrew, that's manna. So for the rest of the time, manna is called the what is it bread, I guess, because that's what it meant in that language. It was like a white coriander seed in color, not so much in texture, I don't think. And there's coriander seed to give you the idea of kind of an off-white color of it. Israel was to eat manna for 40 years. And when we get to the end of this quarter, Lord willing, we can see that when they entered the promised land and began to eat off the fat of the land, the manna stopped. God provided them with food in the land of promise 40 years later, a little more than 40 years. An omer of manna was kept in the ark for future generations to see. I think that's really interesting in chapter 16 and verse 32. Moses said, "This is the thing that the Lord has commanded. Fill an omer with it, with the manna, to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness and brought you up out of the land of Egypt." There's no record, as far as I know, of that being shown further on to generations. But the fact that it was there could be shown, and probably was shown, when people wondered about this story. Well, what was manna like? You can just hear the kids asking, "Well, what did that look like? What was it like?" And well, we have a preserved example for it in the ark that we could look at. Don't know how many generations that existed for, but it's a fascinating visual for future generations to say, again, this is a true story. This really happened. This is not something that is a figment of people's imaginations. So there's a reason for that. There's a little chart of biblical measurements. These are dry goods measurements. You have a cab, which is about a quart, an omer, which is about 2 quarts, a seah that we hear about sometimes, 3.3 omers, and an ephah, which is 3 seahs. That's about a little over half a bushel. Those dry goods measurements will be frequented as we go through Exodus, especially Leviticus, and Numbers as well somewhat. So that'll give you an idea of what we're talking about. Those measurements to me, always over the years, you know, you read that and, well, how much is that? How much are they talking about, right? So it helps to kind of get an idea in our minds of how much that is. As we continue on the trek from Egypt to Sinai, I think it's good here to observe a couple of things. I'm going to read a verse in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 3 just real quickly. This is at the end of the 40 years, and Moses is reminding the Israelites of all that they've been through, and he's talking about this time, reminding them what happened 40 years ago. And Moses says to the Israelites in Deuteronomy 8 and verse 3, "He humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord." God was teaching them, showing them what was important. And so the observation is made in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses reminded the people of how God had tested them during their time in the wilderness. Moses said that God humbled them by letting them go hungry so that they can learn that man's greatest need was not food, but obedience. It's fascinating that he feeds them with something they had never seen before. What'd they say? What is it? We haven't seen this before. We hadn't eaten this before. We didn't even know this food existed. Wow. You mean God's going to keep his promises whether you know how he's going to do it or not? What a lesson, right? Well, God can't do that. That doesn't even exist. That's an impossibility. Like manna in the wilderness, right? Like that? That's what he taught them. He's to be trusted. He's to be trusted. Man does not live by bread alone, but by obedience to the word of God. All right. Travel on from there in chapter 17. All the congregation of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin according to the commandment of the Lord and camped at Rephidim. There was no water for the people to drink. Seems like we've been here before. Again, it's a desert. It's a wilderness. There's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. As we're thinking about a conservative estimate of this with women and children and the mixed multitude that went along with them. 2 million-ish people. And there's no water to drink. That's a problem. Therefore, the people contended with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." So Moses said to them, "Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?" The people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses. "Why is it that you brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children in the wilderness and our livestock with thirst?" Moses asked the Lord what to do. And of course, the Lord provides water. He says to Moses in verse 5, "Go on before the people, take some of the elders with you, take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. And behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb." Now notice, they've come to Rephidim, but they're very close to Horeb, Mount Sinai. So Rephidim and Horeb are very close together. That could be important in a minute. But what happens is Moses was told to strike the rock. The people may drink. Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, end of verse 6. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel and because they tempted the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" The word Massah means trial, and the word Meribah means contention. Now, remembering what I said about this route is the traditional one, it makes sense to me. There are places along the way that make sense. I'm not 100% sure that it is. But again, we can look at some places along the way and say, "Oh, well, it really could have looked like that," because there are a lot of places out here that look like that. And this place in particular is pretty interesting because there is a rock very close to the traditional Mount Sinai that looks like that. And this is traditional Rephidim in the Sinai Peninsula, not far from traditional Mount Sinai. And that rock kind of stands out, doesn't it? I mean, you'd have to, in fact, there are some people that have studied it somewhat and think that they can even see where there have been streams of water flowing there in times past. I'm not for that necessarily, but that's the claim of some. But that definitely stands out in this area. And again, if that's not what it was, it probably looks something like that, because there's a bunch of things like that out there. What comes up next, though, interestingly, is a war with Amalek. Verse 8, Amalek came and fought Israel in Rephidim. Now, we just said Rephidim is really close to wherever Mount Sinai is. So the one is close to the other. This also is where Amalek came to fight Israel. Well, where is Amalek from? Where are they dwelling at this time? We don't have to guess about that, because the spies who go to spy out the land tell us in Numbers chapter 13 and verse 29 that the Amalekites dwelt in the land of the Negev, the south of the Promised Land. They dwelt in the Promised Land to the south end of the Promised Land. That's pretty significant when you're trying to locate where this is. So that's not on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba. That's the south of the Promised Land, right? And we know what the Promised Land is. We know the borders of it. And Amalek dwelt in the south of that, according to the report of the spies. So, again, all that seems to fit together. I think there's a pretty strong case for the traditional path, but I wouldn't want to claim that to be absolute. Here, Amalek attacks Israel. Joshua will lead the attack of, the counterattack, if you will, of the people of God against the Amalekites. Moses tells Joshua to choose some men and go fight with Amalek. Verse 9 says, "Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand." Joshua did as Moses said and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up on top of the hill. So it was that when Moses held up his hands, Israel prevailed. When they began to drop, Amalek prevailed. So they set a rock under him, and Moses sat there, and Aaron and Hur hold up his hands, and Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Amalek was the son of Eliphaz, the grandson of Esau. So these people were related to the Israelites. Again, and inhabitants of the land to the south of the Promised Land, the south part of the Promised Land. They become mortal enemies of Israel through its history, all the way apparently into the time of the captivity. The Lord has it recorded that He will blot out the remembrance of Amalek in verses 14 through 16 here. He's going to take them out and wipe them out. It doesn't happen immediately. There'll be another war with Amalek before we enter the Promised Land. In 1 Samuel 15, the first king of Israel is told to wipe them out. He doesn't quite do it, does he? A king by the name of Agag, who has to kill him? Samuel, right? Saul wouldn't do it. When we get to the book of Esther, Haman is an Agagite, a descendant of Agag. So apparently the Amalekites were maybe a thorn in the flesh of the Israelites all the way into the time of the captivity. But here they're conquered handily, and Moses erects an altar to the Lord, and he calls it, "The Lord is my banner," verse 15. Moses built an altar, called it, "The Lord is my banner. Because the Lord has sworn, I will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." One of many sort of memorials, honoring stones and such that will be erected by God's people. Just really quickly, we don't have a lot of time to look at this, but next thing that happens in chapter 18 is Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, comes. Jethro is a priest of Midian, the text tells us. Hearkening back now, we're still technically in the patriarchal age. So Jethro is a priest of Midian. He brings Moses' family to him here by the mountain where Moses had first encountered God from the burning bush. He brings the two sons of Moses, Gershom and Eliezer. Of course, and they'll figure prominently into the story as it goes on. Jethro certainly recognizes the greatness of God, and how its deliverance demonstrated his greatness. And he acknowledges God for that, as a true priest of God would. He gives praise to God. So this Jethro is sort of he's a bit enigmatic as far as we don't know all there is to know about him, but obviously one who appreciates the God of heaven. And he gives counsel to Moses concerning how to organize the judging of the children of Israel. Moses was doing it all, you remember, and Jethro gives him some good counsel, no doubt as the priest of God, about that, and Moses follows that counsel to divide up the judging into groups of thousands and hundreds and tens and all that sort of stuff and have leaders over that, so Moses doesn't have to sit all day and judge every case in Israel. And so that's an interesting sort of setup to the way the government of the wanderers in the wilderness went. Finally, in chapter 19, verses 1 and 2, Israel arrives at Mount Sinai. It says, "In the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness, of Sinai, for they had departed Rephidim and come to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain, and Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him to him from the mountain." So what we've come to here is, in this third month, the children of Israel come to Mount Sinai, the place where God had first talked to Moses and where he'd said he would meet him again. And that, of course, is coming true. This is a picture of traditional Mount Sinai in the Sinai Peninsula, or Horeb. No matter where you go in this area, yeah, it is nothing. It's trackless, and it's truly desert. And you wonder about that. We're not told. They did have flocks through the time. Obviously, they were sacrificing a lot of sheep. Sheep are fairly hardy animals, and I've seen them in southern Judea, where it's every bit as arid as this. Staying there. But I don't know. I don't know enough about that to say. Good question, though. All right. Here's kind of where we went from tonight, from the starting point at Ramesses, all the way down to Mount Sinai. Traditional route, at least, is what we've looked at on the map. Right, any other questions or thoughts? All right. We'll pick up there Sunday morning.